You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferris. Coming up, we'll learn about both the biology and the cultural significance of the mushroom. First, few kinds of fungus have earned the gastronomic respect of the chanterelle. Prized for its flavor and aroma, the chanterelle is a summertime treat that Wisconsin Life commentator Brett Laidlaw looks forward to every year.
When the summer has been warm and wet, I start to look for them the first week in July. In the deep shade of oaky slopes, they push up through the thick mat of dead leaves, bursts of gold and orange erupting from the drab duff. You spot one by a rotting log, catch a corner of another down the hill, and then a cluster in the moss. Scanning farther, you observe a thrilling constellation of brilliant fungi spreading out across the forest floor. It's a minor miracle of the mushroom world, the fruiting of Cantharellus sabarius, the golden chanterelle. Morels get all the attention of mushroom lovers in these parts, but chanterelles are just as delicious. Maybe they're overlooked because they appear in midsummer, when a trip into the hot, humid woods can be a bit harrowing. To reach my favorite chanterelle grounds, I wade through a sea of vicious nettles, fight through thorny fortifications of prickly ash and blackberry razor wire, all the while swatting away mosquitoes and deer flies. Once I've run this gauntlet, I stop and take a deep breath, clear my bleary eyes. As many times as I've stood in this exact spot, knowing exactly what I'm looking for, it's never less than a total thrill to spot the first golden furl glinting in the oak leaves. I drop to my knees and cut the stem just above the ground. Bringing the mushroom right up to my nose, I inhale. Shivers run up my arms and neck. The scent of the chanterelle is often compared to apricots, but it also reminds me of fresh sweet corn sliced from the cob, or a fragrant pumpkin cracked open with a big, sharp knife. Mainly, they smell like chanterelles, haunting and unique. They're wonderful to look at, too. The stem swells gracefully toward the cap, the underside of which is lined with delicate, irregularly forking veins. Their color ranges from pale cream through sunny yellow to deep, vibrant orange. It's like nothing else in the mushroom world. In cooking chanterelles, the best you can do is the least. Sauté them in good butter and spoon them onto a piece of toast. Cook up a classic French omelet of the freshest eggs. Sauté sliced chanterelles with a bit of minced shallot, and you have a sunny plate of utter simplicity and deliciousness, well worth the trek into the summer forest.
Now, our next guest really loves mushrooms. So much, in fact, that he's spent his career as a mycologist, that's a mushroom scientist, and he's written several books on the subject.
Nicholas Money is a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio, and his most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to talk with you, Judith.
I think when most of us think of mushrooms, we think of what pops up above the ground, especially in damp and shady areas. In your terms, what is a mushroom?
Well, mushrooms are fruit bodies, or we might say that they're the sex organs that are produced by microorganisms that spread through soil or rotting wood in the form of these microscopic filaments. But those filaments can span over an enormous territory. So the structures that are produced above ground then are these, as I've said, the fruit bodies, and their function is to produce and release spores, which they do beautifully. That mushrooms are veritable spore factories, and that's one thing that I've done in my research career and working with students over the years is looking at actually how that works. And I think I'm still mesmerized by the efficiency of this process.
Well, and it's so interesting because they take advantage of a variety of elements and creatures around them to help them in their efforts to reproduce and to spread those spores. So I'm remembering that they use wind, they use water, they use birds, they use animals.
Yeah, there is this amazing diversity of mechanisms that have evolved among the mushroom-forming fungi for getting their spores dispersed. And so, as you say, wind is certainly one of the dominant modes of transmission. But yeah, mushrooms also interact with all kinds of other organisms, forest creatures, and all the way from, you know, nematode worms and rodents and insects, lots of insects, and to also participate in dispersing their spores. So often when scientists talk about mushrooms, they're really referring to the fruit bodies produced by a particular group of fungi called the Basidiomycetes. There's another group of fungi called the Ascomycetes, and those include the fungi that produce morels and truffles. But there's also Basidiomycetes, so things that other normally would form gills that also form mushrooms, form fruit bodies called false truffles, and they operate really just like truffles. So they rely upon being unearthed by mammals and actually dispersed after those mammals consume them.
So you've kind of pointed to this a little already, but how diverse is the world of mushrooms?
So there's about, if we think about, again, these two different groups then in which larger fruit bodies are produced, then there's at least 16,000 species of Basidiomycete fungi that form mushrooms, and a smaller number of the Ascomycetes, but probably we're just looking at a small number of the actual diversity of species in nature then that form mushrooms. There's relatively few scientists that are engaged in finding and identifying new species of mushrooms, and so there's pretty good reason to think that a lot of this diversity has gone unrecorded at this point.
And do we have a sense, Nick, of how long mushrooms have existed?
So the fossil record's kind of interesting. The fossil record is beautiful, but very, very incomplete. So there's whole fruit bodies that have been preserved in amber, and these are absolutely beautiful, beautiful fossils of tiny mushrooms, tiny fruit bodies in amber. They can be dated going back perhaps as far as, the time of the dinosaurs. But the thing with those mushrooms is that they already look much like the mushrooms that we'd find in the woods today. So this suggests that their evolutionary history stretches back much farther than this. But we really, really don't know. But we're probably thinking in terms of a couple of 100 million years.
And what you're saying about the fossil record in reading your book, it made total sense. But I hadn't thought about it before, that just the type of organism that mushrooms are, they don't lend themselves to fossilization very well.
That's right. And there's been this immense extinction that's occurred throughout the evolutionary history of the mushrooms, and today we're left with mushrooms. It's very, very difficult to figure out the relationships between these different mushrooms when there's been such extinction and that the fossil record is so poor.
Nicholas Money is a mycologist and a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio. We're talking with him about his most recent book, Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Nicholas Money. He's a mycologist, and his most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
Let's talk a little bit about that cultural history now, because there are so many amazing things about mushrooms that they really lend themselves to a lot of superstitions and folk beliefs. And one that I just really enjoyed reading about was fairy circles. First, when we talk about fairy circles and mushrooms, what are people referring to?
So mushrooms, what happens when a mushroom colony develops then is that it begins as a single spore. And that these filaments that I've mentioned earlier, then they're growing out in all directions, sort of like spokes on a bicycle wheel, and that colony gets ever larger, and it has a roughly circular shape. And when the fruit bodies are formed, then those are generated around the circumference of that circle, and this is what gives the appearance then of a fairy ring.
And they can pop up overnight.
They can pop up very quickly, yes. That what's happening there is that the fruit bodies are developing underground, and they form a primordium, a little nugget of tissue. But then that expands very, very rapidly by absorbing water. And so one can wake up in the morning and look out on a lawn and see mushrooms that were invisible on the previous day. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, this idea that they're associated with so many myths and legends and superstitions. I mean, on the one hand, this perhaps makes people, you know, it excites people about mushrooms, but the trouble is, too, that they've become associated with so many supernatural doings that it also leads people to think that they're sort of a bizarre part of nature.
Well, I have to say, your book, I've always thought mushrooms were interesting, but your book really did suck me in and get me really interested in. And one of the things that I didn't realize about mushrooms is that some of them have bioluminescence, so they actually glow. And how has that played into some of the beliefs and superstitions about mushrooms?
Yeah, so exactly. So that's one of the sources of superstitions about mushrooms and other fungi, then, is the fact that they glow in the dark. And there's been some beautiful research done on these bioluminescent mushrooms in recent years, particularly by some researchers in Brazil. And so it turns out there's a much greater diversity of mushrooms that will luminesce. And in tropical forests, for example. And the function of this is really not well understood, but it could be related to the attraction of insects, and that those insects might play an important role in dispersing spores. But on just another level, it is a remarkable phenomenon to actually see mushrooms glowing in the dark, and there's a few species in North America that do this, and it's a wondrous phenomenon.
There are some, how should we say it, some similarities between some mushrooms and some human sexual organs. I'm guessing that too has led to some interesting beliefs or thoughts about mushrooms.
Yes, absolutely. So certainly phallic mushrooms have always been I suppose, since we emerged from the Rift Valley, you know, but humans have always been remarked upon the similarity in shape, perhaps, between certain mushrooms and parts of the human anatomy.
And have there been beliefs relating to, say, mushrooms being able to help with virility, for instance?
So absolutely. So the doctrine of signatures types mm-hmm. of ideas, then, that by consuming these mushrooms, at least in their primordial or egg stage, that maybe this can act as that they have aphrodisiacal properties. Yeah.
How long have humans been talking about mushrooms and writing about mushrooms?
So the mushrooms are mentioned in a number of the classical works by authors like Pliny, and so yes, they were certainly the subject of the Romans there were many mushrooms that were used in Roman cuisine.
Actually, I can vouch for that.
Quite that far back, but yes, so. But they were also interested in potentially the medicinal properties of mushrooms. So, and they certainly appear in Roman art, in frescoes and so forth. So, yeah, those are the earliest written accounts that we're aware of.
And were people eating mushrooms for pleasure that far back?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Things like Caesar's mushroom, a species of Amanita, appears to have been eaten for a long, long time, many, many centuries, yeah.
And there are some mushrooms that can be very, very dangerous. They can be fatal or can make you extremely sick. What percentage would you say of mushroom varieties fall into that category?
Yeah, well, it's a minority of mushrooms that are truly, truly dangerous, but one has to be exceedingly careful because there are some lookalikes. One, you know, that you can find a mushroom, and well, many people have, of course, made this the last error of their lives by misidentifying a mushroom, but this is a minority of species, and if any of your listeners actually can get out into the field with a local mushroom group, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things that mushroom societies can do, is actually educate people so that they can correctly identify mushrooms, or at least recognize the really bad ones, the things to avoid.
So there are medicinal mushrooms, but then, and maybe there's some crossover, there are also hallucinogenic mushrooms. What is it about those mushrooms that have that effect on human beings?
So there's a lot of interest in hallucinogenic mushrooms right now, and in particular those that contain a compound called psilocybin. And these magic mushrooms, indeed, that they're not legally, but they are cultivated for human consumption. But
there is actually research going on here at the University of Wisconsin exactly on that.
Yeah, and so there have been some remarkable studies published on the effectiveness of compounds, psilocybin in particular, that gets converted to a compound called psilocin after we consume this, that this has remarkable effects on mood elevation. But, I mean, this is clinically very significant, that there's this there's a study just published in the last few months showing that consuming at least the purified compound then produced by these mushrooms can be very effective at sort of rebooting people that have been suffering from very severe clinical depression, and this can perhaps put them on a different path. This is really interesting. So it could be useful in sort of palliative care, end of life care, and perhaps in many other circumstances too.
The last chapter of your book focuses on mushroom conservation, and I'm not sure mushrooms are one of the first things that come to mind when we think about protecting natural resources. Make the case for us, Nick.
Oh, make the case for conserving mushrooms. I suppose it begins with the fact of the hideousness of our species and the way in which we have and are continuing at an accelerating rate to reshape the biosphere, and mushrooms are among the organisms that we are endangering or threatening through those activities. That so obviously, if you think about clear cutting of forests, obviously the trees are gone, but also the fungi that supported those trees are disappearing. So this is some, as a mycologist, I'd rather see more mushrooms and fewer human beings, but perhaps that won't resonate with every member of your audience. But also actually that we impact mushrooms through picking them. And this is a somewhat controversial issue when you think about individuals picking for their own kitchen, but the real problems, I think, come when we think about commercial picking, where people are going into areas and picking every last fruit body and doing this season after season. And so we're engaged in an experiment right now to just look at the effects of not a controlled experiment, but looking, we will see the effects of commercial harvesting of mushrooms on the health of those populations over the coming decades.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for talking with us and for sharing your passion for mushrooms with us.
Thank you so much.
Nicholas Money is a mycologist and a professor of botany at Miami University in Ohio. His most recent book is Mushrooms, A Natural and Cultural History.
One of the most eagerly anticipated rites of spring here in Wisconsin is morel mushroom season. Fans of the elusive wild morel are notoriously secretive about their favorite hunting spots. You even have to get up early to find them at farmers markets because morel season is short and they're a hot commodity. Kirill Owen takes us to meet the pros, the mushroom sellers, at the Dane County Farmers Market.
I always think of them as a big inside-out nostril. I don't know if that's kind of gross or not, but... They have that kind of a porous appearance to them, I guess.
My name is Nathaniel Jones. I go out with my dad every spring, and we search for morels anywhere. Some people actually come up to the table here and say, "What are these? I've never seen them before." And we tell them they're morel mushrooms. They grow anywhere.
You want to find them where the sun shines all day. And then as the season climbs on, you change. I'm not a great hunter. My husband does all the technical stuff. He tells me where to look. I said, "You find them, I'll pick them."
Your standard dead elms is where we're finding most of ours. you know, it's like every 10th one that you look under, there's maybe or maybe not morels underneath it. It really depends. It's kind of like gambling, I guess.
Yeah, people say they only grow around dead elm trees. Well, that's not true. They grow anywhere. Matter of fact, my dad's best spot for the last 20 years was in a patch of hickories. And a little known fact about morels is that they're a super succulent. They grow during a rainstorm, similar to a cactus. There was one year that my dad was living in his trailer house in the valley. He was watching one grow. He could actually see it grow. And unfortunately, it grew about, the head was about the size of a football, but a raccoon got it before he could pick it.
They've got a meaty texture and at the same time kind of a nutty flavor. And they're wild. That's kind of almost a little mysterious, I guess. There's lots of recipes out there, but I think everybody primarily cooks them in butter. Butter, salt, and pepper.
I cut them in half. Mm-hmm. I rinse them with water. And then I fry them in olive oil and a little bit of butter.
Personally, I prefer them. We take a little butter bowl and shake them around in a bit of flour and then saute them in straight butter. I love them. It's combination of the morel itself and the butter and the flour and the fact that you went out and did all the work to get them and everything. It's a combination of all those efforts.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, research at UW is pinpointing what different types of smiles mean.
Now, there have been a lot of difficult conversations around race recently, including events unfolding as they did in Charlottesville, Virginia, when a counter-protester was killed at a white supremacist rally after a man rammed his car into a crowd. The white supremacists gathered in Charlottesville to protest the removal of Confederate statues.
One extremely difficult conversation about this news is with your kids. Some who are immersed in these issues say that it is never too soon to have age-appropriate conversations with children about race, culture, and how those impact them and the people around them.
Andrew Grant Thomas is the co-founder of Embrace Race, a community of support for parents and other caregivers working to raise informed, thoughtful, and brave children. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, it's good to be with you.
Well, the main case you seem to be making at Embrace Race is that it's important for parents to start talking to their kids about race. Why is it important?
For one, certainly it's important to start talking. It's important to start talking early because, first and foremost, because kids are developing their racial sensibilities very, very early, right? So, you know, we know that at 6 months, literally at 6 months even earlier, kids are making distinctions on the base, certainly can make distinctions on the base of race. And we know that, you know, by the time they end their kindergarten, most kids are making value judgments about the basis of race, right? About associating good and bad, positive and negative qualities with members of different racial groups. So, yeah, we need to start talking early.
And what led you and your wife to decide to found Embrace Race?
So it's definitely a big mix of things. So on the personal side, right, I immigrated from Jamaica to the U.S. as a boy, a black boy of 7 years old. And certainly our experience, the experience of my family in the U.S. Was decidedly shaped by race. My wife, too, is biracial. She was born in this country, but her born of immigrant parents. So, you know, race was salient, race and ethnicity were salient for her family and mine. Then professionally, I've been doing race work and racial justice research and advocacy work for a long time. And my wife, Melissa, spent a lot of time on K-12 education and especially the education of, you know, Latino immigrants and girls of color. But I think the, you know, the crowning factor was becoming parents to two brown-skinned girls who are now 6 and 9 and looking for the resources and community of support to help them, help us, help them negotiate race, its challenges and opportunities, and realizing that there actually was very little out there. There are definitely excellent organizations aimed at helping teachers in the classroom, but much less aimed at helping parents and other caregivers outside of the classroom and outside of the school context.
Andrew, I think a lot of adults have trouble talking to each other about race and maybe even doing it in the first place. What are some ways to get started with, say, younger kids to start to have productive conversations about what race means?
Well, certainly, you know, there's going to be, it obviously depends somewhat on age, but you're going to want to think about how to be both reactive, right, responsive to what they're bringing to you or what the world brings to your family, and proactive. So number one, I mean, I think you really want to legitimize a conversation with your kids. Race is not only okay to talk about, it's good to talk about, right? And when they bring it up, whatever context that might be, it might be about books, it might be about their friends, school happenings, things in the neighborhood, patterns that they notice, I think the first thing is, yeah, great. That's an interesting observation. Let's have that conversation rather than squash it, which a lot of parents, especially white parents, try to do. And then, you know, there are any number of ways to think about engaging race. And it's not only about talking. That's really important. So, you know, just to give one example from my own family, you know, again, my girls are 6 and 9. They've had a lot of babysitters over the years. And one thing we've tried to do, which we haven't done nearly as well as we might have, frankly, is in trying to get babysitters, right, where we try to get babysitters who are both male and female, right, and who have all racial stripes, not least so that I, as a black man and black father, I'm not the only male of color they see as a loving provider for them. So that's just a specific example, but there's actually a lot of things we can do.
We're talking to Andrew Grant Thomas about raising kids and talking about race and issues of race with them. He's a co-founder of Embrace Race. Andrew, we heard ahead of the show from Sean on Facebook, who wrote, Martin Luther King Jr. was colorblind. To be colorblind is to try to see people for who they are as a person, not as a member of their race, to judge them by the content of their character, not their skin color. This isn't, Sean writes, mutually exclusive with recognizing racial trends and fighting for equality of opportunity. But this idea Sean's bringing up of maybe we should be working toward colorblindness, you've written elsewhere that doesn't necessarily work out with kids.
Yeah, it doesn't. So, you know, first of all, I'm going to disagree with Sean's premise. I mean, that King was colorblind. I know the content of their character quote is his most famous one. But, you know, consider that he was killed in Memphis, and he had come back to Memphis having been there a few months earlier, you know, helping the striking sanitation workers in Memphis, right? I mean, he knew that the economy certainly wasn't colorblind. But more to the real thrust of Sean's point, I mean, I think on one hand, we can certainly have a talk about whether or not we should aspire to color blindness, and that might be something we want to do. There are also arguments why it might not be something we want to do, but that's very, aspiring to color blindness is very different from insisting that the world and our society as it is now is already colorblind, right? So, you know, in a world, in a society which criminal justice and the economy and healthcare and education and employment are all profoundly race conscious, pretending not to see race when most people and most organizations and most institutions are very race conscious, really is only hurting the people who are most vulnerable to begin with.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Jason on the line in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jason?
Well, I have two children. I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son, and they have access to social media, and they pay attention to this kind of stuff. And long before, you know, this last huge incident happened, they, you know, they had questions, and I was put in a position where I had to either pick, you know, the parenting sugarcoat method of don't worry about that, you're too young, I'll take care of it, or, you know, listen. And so They don't think there's anything wrong with someone being a different color. My daughter is a part of a group in her middle school that welcomes transgenders and all the different choices that kids can make. And so I've never looked at other people as what you see. I teach my kids that everybody is just like us, which is one second we believe something, the next second we doubt it, the third second we believe it again. And that's how people work. So if you try to identify somebody as a certain type of person, well, then you're just giving, you're doing yourself a disservice. And so I want to tell other parents that if you want your kids to grow up to be open-minded and reasonable, that they can't ever assume, because none of us have met everybody. None of us will ever meet everybody. And because there's so many options of how to be and how to think, labeling somebody based on color or any of those things, especially religious choices and such, that's just, it doesn't even make sense.
Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, your thoughts on what Jason had to say?
Well, I appreciate Jason's comment. I guess there are a couple of things to say. On one hand, of course, he's right, right? So there are millions of African-American people, millions more of white people, Latinx people, Asian-Americans, Native Americans, and so on, multiracial people. And there are huge differences, right? There are all the differences you can possibly imagine within each of those groups. So to say that we know someone on the basis of racial identity alone clearly doesn't make sense. On the other hand, as far as that goes, I certainly agree with Jason. On the other hand, the truth is that in this society, we make these distinctions, right? So, let me name just one, but this is not just my sort of personal sense of things. We have tons and tons of research, right, that takes sort of our subjective opinions out of it and tells us what, in fact, we see. So, think about the fact, for example, that our social networks, our friendship circles, are very segregated, right? We know this. There was a survey done a few years ago in which 75% of white Americans had no close friends who were non-white. Almost as many African Americans, that was true of almost as many African Americans, and true of roughly half of Latino respondents. In Wisconsin, Milwaukee, a sociologist named David Pager sort of did a very well-known study looking at whether or not, looking at black and white men who had criminal records or did not have criminal records, and whether and how they were able to get jobs. And what she found is that white men with criminal records did better, right, were more successful in the labor market than black men without criminal records. So, again, we can aspire for ourselves, for our society, for our kids to be, quote-unquote, colorblind. But the truth is the society is colorblind. The truth is also that we individually are colorblind. And if Jason's kids are, 13 and 9, I think he said, to think that they don't see race, at school they're not talking with their peers and friends about race, is frankly, unless they're the most unusual and perhaps unique kids in the country, it's frankly just not true.
Andrew Grant Thomas stays with us now. He's the co-founder of Embrace Race. We're talking about the idea of raising race-conscious kids.
And we want to hear from you. Do you talk to your children about race? How do you handle issues of racial inequity when they come up with your kids? Did your parents talk with you about those issues? And teachers, what ideas do you have when it comes to tackling these difficult issues with your younger students? Post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our discussion about talking to your kids about race and racial issues now with Andrew Grant Thomas. He's the co-founder of Embrace Race.
You can join the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. How do you handle issues of race with your own kids or grandkids? If you work with younger children, what tips do you have about talking to them about racial inequality or other racial issues? Is raising race-conscious kids something you've thought much about? Wonder how to do it? Share your thoughts and see what others have to say over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andrew, how about that situation I just mentioned? A parent thinking, yeah, I want to talk about issues of race with my kids. I don't know what to do or where to start. How do you recommend they get started and maybe look for resources too?
Well, certainly that's why we're here. I mean, we, you know, Embrace Race alone can't fill the gap. It's enormous, but, you know, we have a website and a newsletter. The newsletter, for example, is bi-monthly, and every time it comes out, we have a resource section, resources that parents can use in engaging their kids, whether it's about talking or something else. You know, a Facebook page where we're posting 3 articles a day that we think will be helpful to people. So there's that, and there's certainly other resources. Again, not so many, but they are proliferating, right? Precisely as you said at the top, because of this time that we live in, because more and more people are recognizing how much racial content there is in a way that we used not to recognize. And Robbie, and I just wanted to add just one last thing to Jason's point about his kids, which is, you know, maybe here's one way of thinking about it. We like to think that kids, and especially white children, are colorblind, but human beings in general, and certainly children, and all of us, are really good at recognizing patterns, right? And we're really good at recognizing racial patterns. So whether it's about, you know, who goes to my school versus another school, you know, who lives in the homes in that neighborhood versus this one, who plays on this team in school versus that one, who dates whom, who's friends with whom, they recognize that. So that's a given, right? There's not much we can do about that, and it's not obvious we should want to do anything in particular about that. The really crucial question is, what kind of explanations do our kids come to about the patterns that they see, and where are they going to get those explanations from? Are they getting them from us? Do we have some input? Are they more or less informed, more or less thoughtful ones, or are they just pulling it in from the popular culture, from their peers, whatever it may be? I think that's where we need to focus our attention.
I want to bring on another caller now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Yes, hello. This is a great discussion. You know, I don't know if you can raise totally colorblind kids, but you can raise colorly aware kids. And it's not so much what they see, it's how they respond to what they see and how they act. Actions are louder than, you know, any explanation a parent gives. So, first of all, my color-aware child was raised by a black grandmother and white parents. And so at family reunions, you know, it was a rainbow out there. So she's had the advantage of growing up from a very young age, you know, exposed to all cultures, and it's been rich. She moved to Menominee, Wisconsin as a fourth grader, walked in her class, sat next to who we call in our family Tiny Bowman, which is a generic name for anyone who's very big and overweight. I walk in 3 days later. I look at the class. She says, Mom, I'm sitting next to Tiny Bowman. I walk in. She's sitting next to the only African-American child in the class. This is in fourth grade. You got to give kids a little more credit. I think that if you bring up race too early and talk, you're wasting your time. Kids are very aware of this. It's all over Facebook, these little interviews with these adorable children. Tell me how you're different from your friend. Well, he likes horses, I like dogs.
Mm. Martha, thanks for the call. So a couple points there, having role models, different family members in this case, but just being aware and exposed to people from different backgrounds. But then on the other hand, Martha says, don't talk about race too early. So your thoughts, Andrew?
Well, you know, it's I'm not sure what we can get from particular anecdotes, right? So, you know, it's not as if no one suggests that kids notice only race, right? As if the only thing characteristic that's important to them is, you know, the racial identity of the kid they're sitting next to. So I'm not sure that, you know, identifying, you know, sort of thinking of the black kid she was sitting next to, you know, share some characteristic with another kid who wasn't black. I'm not sure what that tells us. Again, what we know, it's important, I think, to, you know, where we can, to actually pay attention to what seems to be the rule, right, rather than to what may or may not be exceptions, which is why, you know, I hesitate sort of to talk. I certainly don't rely in what we're doing in Brace Race on anecdotal accounts. We really do have very, very strong evidence that whether kids refer to race or not, they see race, right? And they make inferences about race. And in fact, very often when kids, certainly by the time a kid is in fourth grade, let's say 9 or 10 years old, she has already learned that many adults, perhaps all the adults in her life, think it's a bad idea, right? That race is a taboo subject. So we have, you know, we have these scenarios where, for example, we'll, you know, they do experiments where kids are asked to describe photographs of people to each other, right? So I have a partner, I have in front of me, you know, a picture of someone, and one of the obvious ways to describe the person might be to say, this is a white boy, or this is a, you know, a black boy, or whatever it is. And even in those circumstances, many kids will not, most kids will not describe the racial identity of the person, even in a competitive situation where doing that would allow them to win the game, right? So, you know, it's not that they don't notice race, it's that we've told them it's wrong to notice race and wrong to talk about it.
Andrew, as we wrap up, you talk about a tip you give at Embrace Race, and on your website, embraceface.org, is to prepare for a marathon, not a sprint, when it comes to talking with kids about race. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I think we, so many parents, and again, I think white parents in particular, but not exclusively white parents, are, as you said earlier, Rob, are nervous about talking about race, maybe because they don't know how to do it effectively, even if they think it's the right thing to do. And of course, as we've heard on a couple of these calls, there are some parents who think we really shouldn't talk about race or shouldn't talk about race until, you know, the kid is older rather than younger. And that sort of concern, that kind of fear or trepidation in some cases, can lead people to, you know, place so much emphasis on the talk, right? The race conversation. It's too much pressure, and it's actually not quite the way to think about it. The conversation I have when my daughters were 4 or 5 is a different conversation than I have when they are 7 or 8, and that'll be different again than when they're, you know, 11, 12, and so on. And it's okay to not get it quite right. It's okay to not quite have the answers. It's okay to say, let me get back to you, or let's do some research on that. It's over time, right? It's what's the exposure, what's the conversation, what's the learning over time, both in terms of the conversations we have and what we actually do.
Andrew, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Rob, I really appreciate it.
That was Andrew Grant Thomas, co-founder of Embrace Race. You can find the group's tip sheets and keep this conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
So, Rob, we heard a lot about mushrooms earlier, everything from hunting for morels to superstitions and folk beliefs about them to how delicious they are. And now my mouth is really watering. Are you a mushroom fan?
I have done a lot of cooking with mushrooms over the years. I like just real simple, like mushrooms like sautéed with garlic and butter or maybe a little vinegar in them. Mm. And then a Polish mushroom soup, zupa grzybowa.
Yes.
I apologize for my Polish pronunciation. I haven't made that in many years, but I used to like it a
lot.
Does
that have barley in it?
Oh, not the way I made
okay,
it, no, but I think it can.
We always have mushroom barley soup for Polish holidays. My mother used to make a really great mushroom dish, and I'll be making it this weekend. It's sautéed mushrooms with a little garlic, but then you do layers of the mushrooms with a little bit of Parmesan cheese in between the layers, and then bake it so it gets all kind of gooey, and it's just delicious. She used to use the little cans of the mushrooms, you know, that were available, but now I actually start from scratch.
Yeah, and I usually don't get too fancy with my mushroom selection, just those, you know, the plain mushrooms you picture in your head at the store.
The little button mushrooms.
I've gone on a couple failed morel expeditions in my life, I'll say.
I actually bought morels from a kid selling them at a stand, like a lemonade stand one time.
Wow.
But, you know, that was almost as exciting as finding them in the wild.
Well, enjoy your mushrooms this holiday in whatever form you eat them. This is Central Time.